Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome back. This is The Ruck. We have three World Cup winners on the show today, and in that respect, there are no prizes for guessing which of us is the odd one out. I'm Owen Slott. I remain the 1983 Dorking Under 16 tennis champion, a triumph that I feel obliged to flourish were anyone to doubt my credentials when it comes to discussing a high-level sport at a top table that includes, say, Michael Leiner, Sarah Hunter and Laurence Dallaglio. Yes, this is indeed our august panel today. Sarah will be joining us, big campaign on the phone like last week. Michael is back because we love having him on this show. And let's face it, we probably need a strong Antipodean accent to stop the swing low brigade getting too carried away. And Laurence is here making his Ruck debut, which is just brilliant. Laurence, there's a cap presenting ceremony afterwards. And like all debutantes, you have to sing a song on the tube home afterwards.
Wonderful.
So we look forward to that. Laurence, great to have you here. Less than 24 hours since England won at France, 44-8. How are you feeling today?
Well, a big smile on my face. I mean, it's been an amazing performance, an extraordinary couple of weeks, really, in Dublin and then Twickenham. I guess I sort of questioned whether we'd seen England's best performance of the championship in Dublin, because I didn't think they were capable of necessarily repeating that level of performance. And by that, I mean the 80-minute performance that we've seen under Eddie Jones. And obviously because of the quality of the opposition that Ireland were. But you know, Eddie Jones talked in the build-up about, you know, he felt that they've reset, they've brought themselves back down to earth after that wonderful win in Dublin, and that they can play better than they actually played in Dublin. So, no, I'm feeling pretty good about life. You know, Eddie Jones seems to have his mojo back. It's been a tactical masterclass in both games. You know, very different tactics, but you know, executed superbly by his team. And England are very much back at the top table and dining, and enjoying it.
Yeah, I think that's a key point, Lawrence, that, you know, the two victories so far have been very different tactically, but brilliantly devised and then implemented by, devised by the coaching staff probably and the leading players, but also then implemented beautifully on the pitch. I mean, literally, you know, to score a try in the opening 2 minutes, you know, this one on Sunday was within a minute. You know, it's fantastic, and it just set up the whole thing, but very different in the way they did their tactics and really exposed the French back three and took them apart. And then Johnny May scoring three purely because of that.
I mean, I think, you know, to Michael's point, what's been so different about England is that they've come out of the blocks fast in both games. One of the things, even when England were on a big run under Eddie Jones, where they won 22 out of 23 games, there was always this nagging worry for me that they were slow starters. Waited for the opposition to come at them, and you can't do that in international rugby, not against the very best. And it cost them victories in Paris, it cost them last year against Ireland and against Scotland particularly. But you know what a difference it's made. I'm not sure what's happened, but
it's almost like England are setting the agenda. This is the way this game's going to go, and this is the way we're going to play you, and you like it or leave it. And both teams so far, particularly the French on Saturday, they stayed with it for about 20 minutes, and then actually there was only ever one winner.
Which France are going to turn up. Well, we knew exactly which France is going to turn up. They're fragile. If you throw away a 16-point lead, you know, with inexperienced players in your side, you're going to arrive at Twickenham pretty fragile, especially after England's performance. But it's up to England to expose that fragility, and boy, did they do it in...
I think France are in a real mess because, you know, the first game they had against Wales, you know, they played well in the first half. It looked good, and they had these young guys in the centres and, you know, playing well on the backs, etc. And then they lose that game, and then they panic as usual, and they bring back Bastereau into the centre. I just felt that sent a signal to England that just... And then they picked three... back three, all out of position, to play a test at Twickenham. It just smelt of desperation, trying to find something that might work, rather than some sort of real plan that might over, you know. So like
I don't know where the logic is. I mean, there isn't logic. I mean, you know, they beat England in Paris last year, and only six of that team were in the 23 this year. So I don't know how do you get any continuity? How do you know, they keep chopping and changing their side. They've got such a high turnover of players. I can't remember the last halfback combination that played more than two games consecutively. You know, they think that they think the nine is the king, when the rest of world rugby realises that the 10 is the king, and always will be.
And let's just point this out, that Lawrence is almost on his knees to Michael at the moment.
Absolutely.
And rather than barrowing me into touch or something like that. Yeah.
And I mean, you know, they are minimum stone overweight up front. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're going to pick big guys like that, then you have to have an impact in the first 10 or 15 minutes. Otherwise, what's the point? The rest of the world is playing a totally different game than the French. And this kind of alpha male, you know, top 14 stuff where it's just stop start and just big bulldozing hits is not going to win you anything at international level. No. And they need to lose some weight.
No Jonesy here today, but on that point, his piece in the Times today, so kind of him to join us in the Times today.
Yeah, well, he had to write on a Sunday, so he needs the day off on the Monday, doesn't he?
No, he's feeling it, the poor boy. So this is Jonesy on France. He says, France did not exist. There is no basis on which to work, no core anywhere in the team. They were battered, embarrassed, rubbish, cowed, disorganised, dismal.
Apart from that.
They may as well not have come.
Yeah.
And that was the nice bits he said about them. So, I mean...
Well, they had a collective. They failed collective, you know, HIA, didn't they? Heart assessment, really, because, you know, you could tell the minute the first couple of high kicks went up, and Ouje, again, tactically, you know, England felt that was soft. Why they don't pick Ramos at fullback, I do not know, but they go with Ouje.
But one of the many reasons why they're in the hole that they're in is because they see this new generation of young kids and they think, well, we need to get some talent in. But if you're struggling and you're going to go 16, you're going to lose 16 in the leads and concede early tries, then inexperienced 20-year-olds aren't going to win you.
Yeah, and then the key there is inexperience. You know, just because they won a World Cup a year or two ago, they think that's the answer. Yeah. But they're still going to have a system at home where those guys get experience playing rugby at a pace, international level in France. A lot of them, you know, are battling positions with international foreign players that come in, and B, the pace of French rugby is nowhere near what England play at, and the rest of the world, as Lawrence said. So they're expected to find their feet in international rugby as young 21-year-olds at Twickenham. You can't do it, and they're all out of position as well. So it's just, I think it's a system that is not working at the moment, and, you know, just to pin your hopes on a 20-year-old because he did well at underage level is not the answer.
They've lost 16 of the last 20 test matches. Mm. You know, that is not, we don't know which France are going to turn up. We do know which France, which is just a very poor side at the moment. I mean, most of us, I've got a 50-50 record against France, you know, won 6, lost 6, you know, which is, I'm not terribly proud of, but, you know, they were a very...
Well, you can talk about it here if you like, and if you want to, you know...
In this small room, I feel like I can get something off my chest, but they were a very worthy opponent, you know, in those days. Dimitri Yashvili, who was with us commentating yesterday, described it. He said, you know, we're driving a car and you guys are driving a Formula One car. It's just a completely different sport.
Well, while that allows England to dominate, etc., I mean, just on France, that doesn't make anyone in rugby happy, does it? I mean, I thought it was a bit sad, really. I mean, you could admire what England were doing yesterday, but France and the Six Nations have got to be one of the key players in world rugby. They've got to be one of the key players.
It's like cricket, you know, with West Indies. The West Indies are going, well, everybody's happy, you know, in the cricket world. And same with France. Yeah. I mean, while they're really tough opponents when we used to run around, I mean, they were really, really scary people. and they were good. And they had lovely backs. But now it's just sad. I think they're playing a game that's sort of out of date. and it reflects reflected in their club competition. And it is sad, and they need to do something about it and do something pretty soon. I mean, that's coming from an Australian. We've probably got the similar record to the French over the last couple of years, but at least we're trying to play at different pace.
Yeah, that said, we don't need them to hurry up too quickly because there's a small matter of England playing France in the last pool game in Japan.
Yeah, they can do it after that.
They can do it after that. But, you know, we have to pay credit to the way that, yes, they were fragile. Yes, they were there for the taking. But England ruthlessly exposed them, like, literally within a minute, didn't they? Yeah. I mean, they just went for it. They recognised we're playing against, the biggest pack that's probably been picked for quite some time. So let's run them around. Let's turn them with the kicks in behind. So many kicks out of hand yesterday from England.
Oh, yeah. But if you're France and you go into the game saying, you've got to slow it down because we're big, and that's your game plan, slow it down and try and batter an opposition. They're all physical these days. They're going to be able to put up with the big French forwards, and they just played it at such a pace that blew French away. They, 25 minutes into the game, they were gone.
So, Michael, us, Lawrence, like myself in the largely English media, I don't count myself as English media, but we are English-based media. Mm. We two games like that, and our job is to put that in context, and I for one am very aware of getting too carried away, and especially Celtic readers absolutely detest us if we commentators get too carried away with England, think we're England fans. Can you give those two games some context? You know, how positive should an England fan be after seeing
the
last 2 weeks?
Very positive. I think they've been very impressive performances, and you know, a good sign is that you've got a lot of depth there. England have got so many players to pick from, and Eddie's got together a squad. So, for example, Mauro Toji doesn't play this week. Hardly noticed he wasn't there. I mean, that's a world-class player, a fantastic player. Lonsbury comes in, then you've got Cruz sitting there, and Laws.
Laws was amazing.
I thought he was close to man of the match, really. He was just so good. And he just came in for Mauro, and just it was no different.
I had to give it to Johnny May, by the way.
Talking to the man of the match order.
He had one hand on the trophy in Dublin last week, and I cannot believe he didn't get it last week, because he was magnificent. And, you know, you can't score a hat-trick at Twickenham against the French and not get it.
But Laws' little cameo, the sort of 25 minutes he had against Ireland.
Yeah, it was brilliant as well.
I mean, he really made an impact.
And I think to Michael's point, the context we can put around it is that when England have got all their players fit, you know, it's been such a long time since that Eddie Jones has been able to pick from virtually a full strength team. There's still one or two missing, that we've forgotten how good they are. Yeah. You know, this is a team that went on a run of 22 out of 23 test matches, equaled the world record with New Zealand. And because of the last 12 months, we've kind of forgotten all of that. Yeah. And before the Dublin game, I looked at the team sheet and I thought, wow, that is a really strong side, particularly up front. You know, there's six British and Irish lines in the pack alone before you even go to Owen Farrell and Daly, etc. And, you know, I think the thing that's impressed me is, you know, the performance and the quality of it in Ireland. But then, you know, when there's one thing saying, oh, our feet are on the floor and we've reset, but they did it really well in the space of a few days. Maybe because they had such a quick turnaround, they didn't have time to think about it.
Yeah, I just think it's been very, very impressive. And you can think of the guys that are not out there at the moment. And that's what Ireland last year, you know, in the last couple of years, they've developed the really good young people that are coming through. For example, Sexton, a year ago, we were saying, oh my God, if he falls over, Ireland are in trouble. Carberry's come through. They've moved him to Munster to play more rugby. He's come through. And actually, when he came on Saturday, it was pretty impressive. And England have got that in spades. You know, you've got Cock and Aceva and Teo to come back into that back line if they want a bit more size rather than pace.
Eddie,
you know,
is just chomping at the bit to get Cock and Aceva on.
And rightly so. But where?
He genuinely looks like he's got his head right in the right place. I mean, as a coach, you know, and as a coaching team, you know, they're right on it at the moment. And you've got to give them an enormous amount of credit. And, you know, a lot of us... a lot of the media questioned the appointment of John Mitchell.
Me in particular, I wrote an entire column on it. I wrote a column last week undoing it.
Yeah, bit of a mea culpa. Well done, Owen. It was good to see that.
And I guess we'd forgotten maybe, and we probably needed reminding that this is a coach who understands English rugby because he's coached at Sale and Wasps, etc. He's coached with England before, albeit a generation ago, but he's climbed to the very top of New Zealand rugby and coached them. And, you know, you could argue he was only a couple of games away New Zealand were always a couple of games away from winning a World Cup, but you know, he didn't do a lot wrong. So his influence is, you know, along with Eddie Jones, is really starting to come through. I mean, I dare say that first line-out over the top in Dublin had his hands all over it, really.
Yeah.
And also, you know, Scott Wiseman.
Scott Wiseman.
You know, he's got the, he brings in this sort of eccentric, mad sort of side, and then you've got
Borthwick. Did you know Scott through Australian rugby?
And he's a great thinker of the game, and, you know, a little bit out of the box as well. But if you put jigsaw puzzles together, you've got people that think about the game, and, you know, Scott might come up with something that's quite wow, that's out of the box, but can we actually do it, you know, on the field? And so you've got these good sort of different sort of levers being pulled, and it just seems to all work. But isn't it, you know, a year is a big time difference. And, you know, a lot of times that, you know, Eddie might have, you know, been out of a job after the sort of run he had last year, but they've stuck with him. And now he's come through it, and boy, they're in a good place.
You know, and in adversity, some good things have come. You know, they found some real gems in there. I mean, you know, Mark Wilson has played unbelievably well. He would never have got a chance to play in an England shirt had there not been so many injuries.
Yeah, and a couple of the front rowers as well. Yeah. You know, Moon and those sort of guys have come through.
And, you know, he's been magnificent. I mean, there's opportunities, I'm sure, in the rest of the only blot I could think was why, you know, was maybe he could have brought Dan Robson on 10 minutes earlier. But
I was looking at my watch going, this is just cruel, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, but then again, you know, Ben Youngs has been an amazing player because he's playing so badly before the tournament.
That's what I was going to say. That is another tribute to the coaching staff, isn't it? Because he comes from playing like a drain at Leicester for a few weeks, and all of a sudden he puts on his England shirt. Yeah.
And magnificent, I mean, against in both games. And that takes some doing when you're coming in with no form.
And also the opposite was sort of a bit the form last year. Saracens players would play great club form. Come into England and you think, oh, England are fine because they got this, you know, the Saracens army. And suddenly they would be brought dragged down a level.
Yeah, one of the keys that here is also is, you know, we're talking about this sort of campaign, being able to pick from the vast majority of the players available for an England squad. So the key between sort of when the Six Nations finish and the World Cup is, you know, how they look after the players that go back to club. You know, that, and hopefully, you know, there's not much more you can do. They're going to be playing rugby every weekend at a pretty high level. You know, if they get through that, then England are in a good spot.
Michael, I really want to ask you about the England tactics or that darting, prodding kick that Johnny May finished off three times, but they used that quite a lot against Ireland as well. So in the times before the Six Nations, we asked George Ford what would be a tactical innovation coming into the Six Nations, and we probably should have put it on our front page now, but this is what George Ford said to us. He said, I think the kicking game is going to be used a lot more. I don't only mean getting out of your own half. I mean when teams are putting 13, sometimes 14 men in the line, leaving one at the back. You can be there all day long, but if you've got all that space in the backfield to try to manipulate space and attacking kicks, then you have a great opportunity. So
it's exactly that.
England did that brilliantly. So my question to you is, it's not the first time that tens or nines or smart kickers have worked out that kick can work. But I've never seen another team do it so relentlessly. And it's come in the age of this blanket rush defence. So do you see that as a tactical innovation? Or do you think teams will change now? Or is it just an accentuation of what we've seen before?
It's not exactly. It's a tactical awareness of what's going on. And, you know, over so many years, it's all been about possession. And, you know, we've seen 18, 19 phases in a row, one out, one out, one out. So, and England have been guilty as anybody else over that as well, when you've got all these big ball runners. So the opposition just line up and mark you up and tackle you. So particularly on the weekend, though, when you pick three players that are out of position at, you know, wingers and fullbacks for France, you know, there's the option. France are going to come up and try and smack England and be physical, and their space is in behind. As good as your kick and your chases, and the kicks were brilliant, and the chase, Johnny May just outpaced everyone, made them turn around. So it's actually, and now everybody will be aware that that's England's tactics, so they'll be leaving them back.
Made a small win against Wales in a fortnight's time.
We had a guy called Dave Allred in 2003 who worked tirelessly with all the backs and one or two of the forwards, but let's be honest, all the backs on their kicking game. And it wasn't just, you know, the nines and the tens. It was, you know, we called it the forward pass because that's exactly what it was. It was interesting, Johnny Wilkinson making reference to it yesterday. Now, clearly, Eddie Jones had targeted not just turning the French pack, who, when they're gargantuan, you know, the last thing they want to do is have to run back to, you know, to chase kicks. But it's just that ability to actually kick and score. And you look at the England's back line, you've got Henry Slade, Chris Ashton, Elliot Daly, George Ford, Owen Farrell, Ben Youngs, you know, they're all incredibly good kickers.
The number of footballers who can put in that sort of a kick is...
And what it does do is it creates doubt in the opposition. So if the ball's continually going behind you when you rush up, you're going to come up slower next time. Or you're going to leave people back. And that's when they use the ball. So it actually creates doubt in the opposition's mind,
There's so much more kicking just generally in the game of rugby. You know, when you look at scrums, you know, you can get a penalty but can easily go the other way. You know, when you look at the breakdown, you know, you can win the win the ruck, but, you know, equally you can get penalised. But the contest in the air now is the thing in rugby. You know, because, you know, that's the thing. The restarts off kickoffs and the contest in the air is the thing that people don't they underestimate, you know. And look at it, I mean, it's brought Ireland to the very top of international rugby. Not just that, but it's been one of the key things. And the last couple of weeks, England have just got, they've nailed it. You know, the aerial battle is so important. And in Dublin and at Twickenham yesterday, they constantly put Ujian under pressure. It's not just the kicks through. They've won the aerial battle.
Yeah, and you mentioned Dave Aldred there. He's out in the sunshine of Queensland at the moment, working with the Queensland Reds.
So, England, terrific start. I'm writing this in my column in the Times tomorrow, actually, but 2 weeks ago we were saying this could be one of the great Six Nations, most competitive Six Nations. Four or five teams could maybe win it. And now I'm looking at going, actually, only one team's really played well. Would you agree? Is that harsh?
Just going back a week now to...
I think in terms of a complete 80-minute performances, which is what you're looking for, England have put 2 9 out of 10s out there, haven't they, really? And very few sides have done that. I mean,
Ireland was a bit stuttering against Scotland, and Scotland a bit stuttering against Italy. Wales won two games but not playing well, which is actually... You know, they played well in the second half against the French, but once again, it was against the French, wasn't it? So, I think you're right.
I mean, England, before the tournament started, you know, Ireland were favourites. Wales talking themselves up quite rightly. They're on a run where they're their best ever run, haven't they? Consecutive wins. Yeah. So, you know, they're finding ways to win games regardless of the way they play. When you looked at England's fixtures, you know, I mean, obviously, the momentum is the word that everyone talks about. And if you win that first game, three home games only two away, albeit only two, the two hardest places potentially for England to go. So if they do go on and win the championship or do anything even better than that, then they will have done it the hard way, because to win in Dublin, I think, was such a tough assignment given where they come from. But you look what happened to Ireland last year. You know, you get that last-minute drop goal against the French, and then everything is laid out before you.
Yeah, and so, as you say, Wales two wins, not a single performance to show off about, not hitting their straps. But
I just quite wonder whether Warren Gatland, in hindsight, probably made too many changes.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I know what he's thinking. If they beat England, who cares? You know, no one will be thinking about, you know, the fact that it was a scrappy game, they didn't get a bonus point against Italy,
etc. Do we have any idea what Wales will be like, though? I mean, one thing we know is that they'll be pumped up to the eyeballs. They'll be, you know, more fired up for this game, clearly, than the other two. The motivation won't be a problem, but they haven't stuck out a good performance yet. So do you expect that just to happen because it's England and everyone cares so much?
Yeah, sometimes you can be too pumped up and rely on that too much. I know it's a big thing, but, you know, particularly in the backs where there's a lot of sort of, you know, more, you know, fine motor skills and stuff like that. But it's going to be intimidating for England. But I just think England have got it answered. No matter where, I can't see sort of an area where Wales is, you know, going to potentially get on top of England at the moment.
Yeah,
I just can't see it.
I think you know, they've got at the moment in the two games that they've played thus far against, you know, two big opponents, that emotionally they've been in the right place. You know, you can win and lose a game of rugby before a ball's been kicked. You know, if your head's not right, and you know, but if they come out the blocks the way they have done, You know, it's going to take a very, very good side to beat them because they've got some outstanding quality in that team. And it will be tough. Don't, you know, make no mistake, away from home in the Six Nations is, although this championship seems to be rewriting all of that because people are picking up away wins. But, it'll be tough. And I just think psychologically it's a huge game for both sides because, of what's at stake, not just for the championship, but for the rest of the year.
Mm. Yeah, well, as you say, Wales have been saying we're the unfancied team, or we've come up on the blind side, no one's really noticed us.
They've just been doing it quietly, haven't they? Yeah. The autumn international.
Well, the last two games have helped them do it quietly because people aren't really rating them. But
no.
I mean, how many times have England gone to Cardiff and been surprised? And they shouldn't be surprised.
There's quality in that squad. I mean. You know, if Warren Gatland picks an entire team of back row forwards, they're going to be outstanding, aren't they? Really?
even with a number of them injured,
they've got some real quality, and they've gone about their business, in the summer by trying to find that depth in their squad. You know, adding new players and just trying to find that tier below what they know is their best 15. And if they're all fully fit, then they're a seriously worthy opponent that can trouble anyone.
Mm. On Italy, so with your deep connections and affection for Italy,
Lawrence has got a bit of connection as well. But
it's a sadness.
Do you really, Lawrence? Yeah, so we've got the most Italian panel ever in this room.
Yeah, yeah.
So after the game, in Conor O'Shea's press conference, one of the journalists said, but he was talking up how it would have been a good performance for Italy, but a disappointing result at the end. And one of the journalists said, well, actually, Wales were pretty bad for Wales. And he was pretty unenamoured with the question. He thought it was a bit disrespectful, and he basically said, listen, every time that we do anything good in Italy, someone just says, oh, it's because the opposition weren't any good. So I just put it out there, where are they? You know, they have this awful run of 19 defeats in the Six Nations consecutively. The World Rugby is talking about this World League and possible promotion relegation from the Six Nations. Do you feel that Italy is still on the rise, or do you think we just say this every year and without really believing it?
I think if you go down a level, the performances of Treviso and the Zebra, is quite promising this year.
Yeah, in Pro 14 they've been better, haven't they?
Yes, and they've, I think Treviso is second in their pool, so you're second or third. So they're going along reasonably well there. And what I think Connor's done pretty well is he's finally got sort of the clubs and the federation at least talking to one another and, trying to do things together a little bit more. So I thought Italy played pretty well on Saturday. And, Wales were poor. Well, actually, that might be the case. But Italy actually put them under a lot of pressure. Wales made mistakes and Italy made a lot of breaks against both Wales and Scotland the week before.
Yeah.
I thought they played in parts against Scotland quite well. It's a tough one, but they've got to come. They've got to start winning. It's all very well to say, we played all right for 60 minutes and our depth is not this, or the referee was against us, or whatever it is, and the opposition were poor whenever we do something good. It only turns around when you start getting results, and it's going to be another difficult year for Italy, I think. But at least underneath the international team, there's some good young players there. They're going okay at club level, so hopefully that will filter through. But they've got a terrible pool once again at World Cup, and the Six Nations not looking good for them. It's a tough world for them.
It is. I think Conor O'Shea is trying to do something different with the Italian team. They only have three players in their Six Nations squad that play their rugby outside of Italy.
Yeah,
And that's a big shift from where they were last year or the year before and under previous regimes. They're trying to build an identity within Treviso and Zebra, rather than having their stars globe-trotting around and not really having that control over their fitness and where they play, which positions they play, etc. So we're not starting to see that filter right up to the very top. We're starting to see it in the European Cup and in the Pro 14. So it keeps changing name. I can't remember.
In the Pro 14,
12, 14. But no, we're starting to see that come through. And I think if we're patient enough, it will be a matter of time before it starts to hit up to international level, because he is fundamentally trying to do something very different from any previous coach.
So Ireland and Scotland, the who had this unsatisfactory game at the weekend when Scotland started brightly, but Ireland eventually sort of controlled it. Do you see those teams the pressure's sort of off in a way because they've both been disappointed with what they've done. Do you think that they'll get stronger through the championship now?
I'm sure, Michael. I mean, the thing is, when you lose your first game, you can't. You know, you go into the championship with only winning it is a success for Ireland and for Scotland. So if you lose, you know, for Ireland, if you lose your first game, there's a massive sense of disappointment, particularly when you lose it to England in the manner that they did. So I thought that actually they, you know, given the way that they were beaten, I thought that they did okay to come back from that. I mean, it's probably because the last time that Irish team went to Murrayfield, they got walloped.
Yes, they did. Yeah.
And I think that was probably also at the back of their minds. And they were probably thinking, you know, we owe these guys one. And you could see there's a little bit of niggle there in that game that sort of, you know, they remembered that. And I always got this. I was talking to Brian O'Driscoll after the England game. We were thinking about, you know, what's going to happen to Ireland at Murrayfield. And he said, Scotland will probably, you know, try and play from too deep and try and do things in the manner that Greg has got them playing.
Yeah.
And Ireland just tightened their grip in the second half, didn't they? Yeah. Too much experience, too much. But in many ways, the loss of Sexton, even though it robbed the game, and Hogg, it robbed the game of two world-class players, it's probably no bad thing for Ireland because, you know, thinking ahead to the World Cup, you know, as Michael's already said, they do need to work out a plan for when, you know, he's injured or, you know, when he stops playing. And they went out the World Cup in the quarter-final last time round because Johnny Sexton wasn't playing. And I don't think Joe Schmidt is going to make that same mistake.
No, well, he got Carberry now. Carberry looks all right.
Recovered well, didn't he, from an intercept, you know, to really impose himself on the game. Yeah. So
Also, Scotland sort of made a few basic errors that on another day they probably wouldn't, that aided Ireland and gave them a bit of momentum. But I think, you know, there was quite a bit of pressure on Ireland to come back because I was over in Dublin a few weeks before the first game, and the expectation of the public there, they were quite confident. Oh, you know,
being in Dublin the day before the game, you were there, Lawrence, weren't you?
Yeah, I was.
I'd never experienced it like it. It wasn't arrogance, but there was a real expectation. Yeah. And, I mean, there was a lot of humour involved as well.
Yes. But there was a lot of pressure on the team to play well. Yeah. They almost expected them to win.
Not easy being the favourites, is it? Just ask the All Blacks. I mean, it's not easy because everyone plays their best game against you, and you know, they are the hunted. I think in hindsight, you know, would Joe Schmidt have picked a different fullback now? I mean, that was again ruthlessly exposed. You know, I'm not suggesting that, you know, it's anything against him as a coach. He's a superb, world-class coach, and he has his reasons. But you know, he obviously doesn't trust you know, Jordan Lama, does he? Because you know, to pick a guy who's never played fullback, well, he has played fullback, but 35 tests ago, you know, was
it's a big call.
Was a big call, and it was one that unfortunately for Ireland backfired.
Yeah, and Lama's the sort of the great young thing of world rugby, but as you say, Schmidt is so on it and so risk averse. At least you would have called him risk averse before he put Robbie Henshaw at 15.
I don't think it's. It's not a slight against any of the Ireland players. I just think it's the message it sent to England. You know, we're playing so well, we can even pick a guy out of position and beat you. You know, that's certainly the way I would look at it, and I'm sure that's the way Owen Farrell and Ben Youngs looked at it as well.
Lawrence, you were saying before we started that it's been a pleasant experience for you in the commentary booth because it hasn't been quite that way for a couple of years.
Yeah, well, I'm obviously completely impartial and neutral, as you know.
Well, that comes across.
I meant that it's been a challenge in the big games. For if you're an England fan, you know, I'm thinking back to 2015 in the World Cup when I was commentating on the England Wales game at Twickenham. And, you know, we did a magnificent job in hosting that tournament. I thought, you know, and I'm not sure it ever quite got the credit that it deserved because of the spectacular failure of the national side. Yeah. But as a tournament itself, the stage was set, you know what I mean? The only people that forgot to turn up were the team. And when you're commentating on that, it's tough, you know, it really is tough. And watching everything melt in front of you. And I've been there as a player, as Michael has, trying to articulate that in the heat of the moment is really, really challenging. You know, when we're going for the corner and not the posts, which I've done a couple of times as well. And then to see it all over again against Australia the following week. They weren't the best 2 weeks of my life because, regardless, you know, I'm not one of these guys that I want my national team to perform brilliantly, and I want players to be household names and for the right reasons and play spectacularly well.
So commentating and biting your tongue at the same time, that's not an easy position to be in. Well, but you've done had that, Michael, as well, when you've been commentating on Australia. Well, you've had good days and bad days.
I've had a lot of bad days recently, but it's sort of you've got to sort of, okay, everybody knows you're Australian or English or whatever it is, so therefore you obviously want your team to do well, but you sort of sit there, you're employed to read the game and try and explain the game to the people at home or describe the game at home. And if I'm not employed to be a cheerleader of the Australian team. I'm employed to be somebody there that can actually talk about the game in supposedly a knowledgeable sort of way. And you try to do that as much as possible.
And you've got to applaud and herald, you know, and when good players do great things on the field, you know, that whether they're English or whether they're Australian or Welsh, or, you know, that is to be admired and enjoyed, and hopefully we try and bring that to life.
Yeah, and you know, you sort of, I'm a long time out of the game, so it's a lot easier. The longer you're out of the game, the easier it is. But if you're still playing with friends, you know, people, if you're still commentating with people you played, yeah, it's pretty tough.
This is The Ruck, and we'll be back in a second.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to The Ruck. Now, we are going to Sarah Hunter, the England captain, who I understand is at a leisure centre in Doncaster. After a really impressive 41-26 victory for England over France yesterday in the Women's Six Nations, England leading that tournament. England were beaten by France last year and were 24-0 up yesterday. France got going into the game later. So, Sarah, some well done to you. Your thoughts from the weekend in your brilliance of a three-point analysis.
So first and foremost, I think obviously being part of the England side was that game that you've just spoken about. I think it was obviously a big game of the Six Nations for us, and I think the way we came out as a team and sort of imposed ourselves on the game and went into halftime with a bonus point already in the bag, and it was like, well, how do we come out second half and back that up, knowing that France are very good and they will come out and they will come back at us. And sure enough, they did that, getting early points on the board second half. But you know, I think right from the minute one, we knew that technically and tactically, like, if we would come to the party, but we actually had to bring a bit more than that, you know, that the mindset of the desire to want to go and win those one-on-one battles, win the 1%ers, and, you know, put your body on your line for your teammates. We needed that, and I think that ultimately is what won us the game, because we certainly did that right from the whistle.
I'm kind of thinking that was the game and the performance that you've really been thinking about primarily for quite a long time, especially after last year.
We've obviously were very disappointed from the Six Nations last year, especially in the manner in which we lost that game in France, sort of right at the death. And then since I don't think we've actually found our way, you know, at times in games we've played well, but we've been in this process of rebuilding with new players coming in, players coming back from sevens, you know, and I think there was a sense in the last few weeks that actually if we got it right, we could put in quite a special performance. And I think we certainly did that in the first half. Second half, I think if you'd seen our circle at the end, we would have been a little bit flat, I think, because of the way in which France finished. They obviously came back and they got that fourth try and the bonus point. And there'll be elements of the game that we look at and we'll have to address and have to work on, because we know as we go on through the Six Nations and through on and we build to 2021 that we're going to come up and we're going to have tougher games where we can't do what we did yesterday and allow a team like France back into the game.
But that, I suppose, always in a way is a positive, isn't it? In that you had such a commanding victory, yet come away with a slight sense of disappointment, or rather could do better where you could do better. Moving on, Italy?
Yeah, Italy up to second table. I think it just shows you where the Women's Six Nations is, that if people looked at it, they probably wouldn't necessarily think Italy would be up there, but it shows you the strength and depth that they've got within their team, and they've really developed over the last few years, that actually they are contenders, and on their day they can beat anyone. And they will probably be disappointed with their 3-3 draw against Wales at home, having gone to Scotland and won there. But they are certainly a team that are growing and getting better. And I think beforehand you would probably have put England, France in the top two. Now it's whether Italy can maintain that position they're in with the games that they've got coming up and stay in there and really challenge for sort of the top spots, where a few years ago they were wooden spoon contenders. So, you know, it's a real sign of how they're progressing in their rugby.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that they would be your biggest threat at this stage for your last three games?
I think obviously we'd be doing a disservice if we didn't look and think sure. about our next game, which is Wales, and playing the Welsh in Cardiff is always a difficult thing to go and do. So that's where our focus is. But you know, Italy are a bit of a bogey side for us when we don't know. We have very tough games against them, and our performances against Italy are somewhat like wavering a little bit at times. So we know that they'll be a difficult prospect when we come across them. But you know, we have to turn our focus to Wales first and foremost before we start thinking about Italy.
Congratulations on a wonderful victory yesterday. I just had a quick question. Given that this is the first championship that you guys have played with fully professional contracts, I just wonder, maybe unfairly, but there's certainly an expectation outside the squad that, you know, that you were going to go out and really perform. Has it been discussed inside the squad at all? Or, you know, is there a little bit more pressure, do you feel, or do you just go out and play as you would normally?
Yeah, I think obviously externally there's everyone, oh, you're professional now, you've got to go and win games and win tournaments. But that's something we've set out right from the beginning, whether we've been professional or not. And I think the pressure that we have within ourselves comes from wanting to perform regardless of whether we're full-time or not. So we haven't talked about that within our squad. What we've talked about is how we can get better and how we can keep raising the standard of our game. And obviously being professional does help us and allow us to do that. You know, the rest and recovery time is probably the biggest thing that will pay dividends for us, because actually when we come to do our sessions, we're, you know, we'll be hopefully rested and ready to go again, you know, whereas before that juggle between life, rugby, work balance was pretty difficult. And, yeah, sure. And obviously some teams are still having to do that.
On the ground yesterday, did you enjoy playing at Doncaster? It was a pretty big crowd there and good atmosphere. It must have been good fun.
Oh, yeah, it was brilliant. You know, going on the road, I think, is really important for us as a team, because we're still growing our fan base. We're still exposing our game to new audiences across the country. And, you know, there's a real hotbed of women and girls rugby in Yorkshire, and you could definitely sense that yesterday. Some people talk about taking the game out of London or taking it to a smaller venue, but we're very aware at the moment of where we are within our fan base and spectators. And actually, let's go to a smaller ground at the minute and we can sell out the ground and get a great atmosphere rather than going to a stadium and maybe getting one stand full and it doesn't look that great on TV because of the camera angles. You know, people watching it could sense and probably feel that the atmosphere that was at Doncaster yesterday, and we certainly felt that out on the pitch. You know, it's great that when tries are being scored or, you know, there's a big hit and the roar from the crowd comes up, or you can hear Swing Low Sweet Chariot around the ground, you know, that does really lift a team. And, you know, that makes difference about playing at home, you know, when you can sense that you've got the majority of the fans on your side helping you through. So, yeah, it's great. And we're off to Sandy Park, so hopefully we'll get the same down in Exeter as well, and just showcase and expose what a great game we're playing at the minute.
Excellent, Sarah. And some thoughts on Ireland back to winning ways?
They would have been happy to go to Scotland. You know, Scotland are a side that are really pushing, you know, to the changes within their expectations, and they've got some great players, and to go to Scotland on a Friday night in the wet and wind, you know, is difficult. But I think Ireland would have been hurting from the game they played against us, and you know that they're in a bit of a transition time, and hearing them speak after the game that we played, and you know they had real sights set on going and turning things around and putting in a good performance to get back to winning ways and get their Six Nations back on track, because they're a side that will build momentum through confidence in playing. So you know it was great to see them get their winning ways back on track, and then building through the Six Nations. And you know, they had some standout performances in that game, with Anna Klapis getting man of the match with like double figures in ball carries, tackles, like the meters she made. So you know, there's some real key performances that will hopefully set them on their way now for the rest of the season.
Excellent. Hey Sarah, listen, many congratulations, thank you very much for coming on, and we'll be talking to you again in a fortnight's time, I believe. We finish the ruck off as usual today with our God Goddess of the Week. Lawrence, you want to go first?
You've been very kind letting me go first. I mean, it has to be Johnny May, really. He is the god of English rugby, the most improved player, I think, in the international game. A supreme display of finishing for his hat-trick. And the way he beat Pernod just from a standing start was incredible. So he gets the God of the Week.
Very good,
Michael. Yeah, well, going second in this, I'll have to find somebody else. But I'm actually going for his boss. I'm going to put Eddie Jones down, because the last 2 weeks I've just felt that he's tactically got everything right. He's used his team very well. He's got them all on the same page and playing very nicely. And after the real sort of doldrums that he and his team went through over the last 12 months or so, I just think to bounce back and play like the way they're playing, and in different ways in the two games so far, I think it's been a tactical and coaching masterpiece. So Eddie gets my God of the Week.
Well, very good. Eddie was actually officially named God of the Week last week, so I'm not prepared to let that happen twice in a row. I tell you who my God of the Week is. It's just because I don't think he's got mentioned enough. We have briefly touched on him. Mark Wilson the last couple of weeks. Yeah. I mean, he has come from a long way back, and he will go to the World Cup, and he might even start in the big games now. I think he's been wonderful.
Yeah, but I agree. He has been great.
But we'll let Lawrence go with this one. He picked the man of the match yesterday, and he can have the God of the Week, same man this week, Johnny May.
He's justifying his decision, mate.
Yeah.
As it's my podcast debut,
we want to make him feel at home.
Fair enough.
You're obviously trying to woo me to come back again.
That's right. Really. Oh, all right, should we get that diaries now then?
Or maybe not.
Lawrence, thanks so much for coming on. Really good to have you here. Michael, as ever, great to have you here.
John.
We'll be back next week. It's a great Six Nations. Please listen next Monday. Thanks for joining us.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.,
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.